It is 2 days before the Passover, and Jesus is in Bethany. Bethany is an important place. It is where Mary and Martha and Lazarus live. It is where, when you're coming to Jerusalem, as they were coming into Jerusalem, Jesus sent the disciples ahead to get the colt that he would ride into Jerusalem. The village he sent them ahead into was Bethany. Bethany is where, as we read that last week of Jesus, he lodged each night. And it was in the vicinity of Bethany that after Jesus had risen from the dead and he ascended into heaven, near the village of Bethany. Well, the name Bethany comes from the Hebrew words bayit, which means house of, and ani, which means poor and afflicted. Jesus liked to spend time with friends in the house of affliction. And today, if you went to the Holy Land, Bethany is in the area of present-day West Bank. It's about a mile and a half east of Jerusalem. So if we look at the map, it's that way. And, sorry, choir, you're left out this time. You're backwards. But it's on the far side of the Mount of Olives. So southeast of Jerusalem there, on the far side of the Mount of Olives. And that's important because if you were sick or afflicted, you were not to be within sight of the Temple Mount. And so it's close. It's a mile and a half away from the Temple Mount. But from there, you can't see the Temple Mount, and the Temple Mount can't see you. And so because of its location, close but out of sight, the village of Bethany became a center for caring for the sick, for helping those who were destitute, and for those who were coming as pilgrims to Jerusalem but were not fit to actually enter Jerusalem. That's where Jesus was. That's where Jesus went to retreat. The temple authorities would never come there. The purity laws would prevent them from venturing into this realm of unclean affliction. But Jesus found this to be a place of retreat. He's most at ease here, most at home here in the house of affliction. And he is at dinner in the home of a leper. Hear that. He is at dinner in the home of a leper named Simon. And what happens at this dinner is lovely. It is graceful. And yet some who were present saw it as a waste. And if you think about it, we know that he is at dinner in the home of a leper. So the only people who would have dared be there would be his disciples and his closest followers. No one else would eat in the home of a leper. So even though they love Jesus, and they will go as far as eating in the home of a leper with him, they question this waste of expensive perfume. And Jesus tells them to leave her alone. He sees the beauty. He says, the poor you will always have with you, and you can help them anytime, but you will not always have me. Now, these words of Jesus have puzzled a lot of people for a long time. Why would Jesus be fatalistic, people wonder, about poverty and people in need? He wasn't. The disciples would have known that Jesus is quoting Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 15, we have the law for canceling debts. And at the end of every seventh year, the law says all debts are to be canceled. Everyone who has lent money to a neighbor at the end of the seventh year is to write off the debt. Don't try to collect it. Don't pressure anybody. Just write it off. And it says, as that seventh year approaches, don't try to keep from lending to anybody so that you don't have to write off the debt. Right? When you happen on someone who's in trouble or needs help among your people, and with whom you live in this land that God is giving to you, you don't look the other way, says Deuteronomy, pretending that you don't see them. It says, don't keep a tight grip on your purse. No, look at that person, open your purse, and lend whatever and as much as that person needs. Don't count the cost. Don't listen to that selfish voice saying, it's almost the seventh year, and turn aside and leave your needy neighbor in the lurch, refusing to help him. He'll call God's attention on your sin. Give freely and spontaneously. Don't have a stingy heart. The way you handle matters like this triggers God's blessing in everything you do, all your work and venture, says Deuteronomy. There are always going to be poor and needy people among you. So I command you, always be generous, open purse and hands, give to your neighbors in trouble, your poor and your hurting neighbors. That's the passage that Jesus is calling to mind for his disciples. Because the disciples don't see the beauty in what she has done. She has prepared the one who cancels the debt of our sin with the generous, heartfelt outpouring of this expensive perfume just before the lavish outpouring of his life. Jesus sees the beauty. But he doesn't explain the beauty to them. He doesn't explain that ever since they crossed into the promised land, they have been canceling debt every seventh year. And the seventh year was the year of fulfillment and of perfection. And now the time has come of fulfillment. We are the needy ones, and our debt is about to be canceled. Jesus doesn't explain the beauty. They've been practicing community and care for one another, how having the poor and needy keeps us open-handed and open-hearted. He just alludes to this passage and praises her. New Testament scholar N.T. Wright warns that some of the greatest truths in life can't be caught in a butterfly net of phrase here, a neat little dogma there. If you try to catch them, he says, you will simply end up pinning them to the page. The butterfly is beautiful, but indeed it will be dead. What we need to do instead, he said, is let the creature fly. Let it spread its wings and do what it does best while we look on in wonder. I think that's true of this passage. We can try to pin down what happened, but what we really need to do is look on in wonder. And so I invite you to imagine and look on in wonder as we remember this story. I invite you to find a way that's comfortable for you. You can shut your eyes and imagine, but just imagine as I tell her story again. We're sitting around the table with friends. It's a low table, low to the ground. You're lying on the ground, propped on an elbow. The smell of rich, home-cooked food fills the air. We're all relaxed, talking, enjoying companionship. A woman enters. She doesn't belong to the group. She looks around and heads toward Jesus. And you wonder, what is she doing? What's that in her hands? What does she want? She stands behind Jesus, and you see it. She has a bottle. She opens it. A wonderful perfume fills the air. She holds the bottle over Jesus' head. And you have this fleeting thought that maybe she's part of the household of Simon. It's customary to pour a few drops of perfume on a guest, a special guest, especially when he sits down for a meal. But then she begins to pour. And she pours and pours all of that perfume. And she rubs it through his hair with her hands. Why? Why is she doing this? Who is she? This perfume is expensive. What is the point of such a waste of a year's salary? Everyone is whispering. The woman takes no notice. She continues to anoint Jesus. And Jesus responds to the whispers as he looks deep into her eyes. What she has done for me is lovely. You see, it wasn't just a good thing. It wasn't just a loving act. It was winsome. It was extravagant. She didn't calculate the cost or care what other people were going to say about it. William Barclay, in talking about her, says, "Love can see that there are things the chance to do which comes only once." Wouldn't this world be so much lovelier if people were more like this woman, who acted on the impulse of her love because she knew in her heart of hearts that if she didn't do it right then, she wouldn't do it at all. Lovely. She felt the impulse of her love and she acted on it. Reminds me of a great C.S. Lewis quote. "To love is to become vulnerable, to risk suffering." She risked. "If you want to make sure your heart is not broken," says C.S. Lewis, "you must give your heart to no one, to nothing, and then it will not be broken. Indeed, it will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable." And as I think about that woman who allowed not only her heart and her impulse to guide what she did, but she opened herself up to be redeemed. I think about some difficult relationships that people share with me. I have a friend who has a difficult relationship with a family member. And maybe you have a friend who has a difficult relationship with a family member. Sometimes that happens. This particular family member lives in another state. And my friend and her family member used to be close. Their parents were close when they were growing up. But since they've been adults, and they're now in their 80s, things have been said about each other's spouses and about each other's children, and their life choices have not been the same, and they no longer see each other, and they really don't have any reason to see each other, and they don't call each other, and they don't write to each other. And when my friend talks to me about it, what she wants to do is something to reconcile, but she doesn't want to concede any wrongdoing in reconciling. She maybe even hopes that she might, in her way of reconciling, move her family member to apologizing to her. Maybe you can relate. It's hard when we think about reconciling not to calculate, not to try to get what's owed to us, not to wonder about the best approach, right? Because when we have somebody that we're a little crosswise with, we like to know exactly how things are going to play out when we begin to approach the situation. But rather than overthinking and quite likely doing nothing, I can tell you my friend has been wrestling with this for years, praying for her family member by name, but has not come to the place that she can do something extravagant. What if you just thought, what would be lovely, and did it? A card? An Easter lily? Just show up on the porch? How often do you have that nudge? That idea to do something, to reach out to someone, and that's as far as it gets. It happens to all of us. I got a note from a friend this week. She had decided that rather than giving something up for Lent, she would mail 40 friends a handwritten note. And now this friend is not somebody that I'm crosswise with in any way. We text each other. We see each other around town. Our kids are friends. But she wrote me a handwritten note. It was lovely. We live in a busy world. And I think about it being 2 days before the Passover and this woman probably having other things that she could be busy doing, getting ready. Our days get away from us. And even though we have the nudge to reach out, to express our love, we don't often do it. We get busy. We let that thought be a fleeting thought. We decide it's probably going to be awkward and we get a little shy about it and we don't do it. We have second thoughts. This woman acted on her impulse. It was irrational. It was risky. It was extravagant. It was lovely. May her story be remembered wherever the good news is told. Amen.